It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Funeral services for the victims of last week's Charleston church massacre are being held on Friday. In the meantime, members of the victims' families are working through the grieving process by forgiving the perpetrator of the Charleston shootings. Joining us now by phone from California is Fred Luskin. He's the director of the Stanford University Forgiveness Project. Dr. Luskin, thank you for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Of course. And these are times when things like this happen that the challenge of forgiveness is on a lot of people's minds.
Well, many in the country were stunned by how quickly the families of the victims of the Charleston shootings forgave the alleged shooter. Were you?
That is a really tough question because I deal with this kind of stuff often. And what you're dealing with here is something very tricky, that there's the necessity of grief and there's the necessity of outrage and pain. When something horrendous like this happens, it's like that's just the normal human response. And there's also the necessity for getting over it and moving on. And it's very hard to know what the right timetable is. I would say that, generally speaking, forgiving this fast is often not premature, because it's not premature, but it's hasty. It's not allowing the full horror of what happened to sink in and be dealt with before the release comes.
So in your experience, is it unusual to see the families of victims arrive at this method of healing so quickly?
There's always a percentage of people who do. What I think makes this so challenging for people like me is that the people who are doing this forgiving are themselves religious people. And so they will have had practice before the experience to create the precondition where forgiveness is more practiced. So that's why I say this is an interesting situation, because it's a little bit reminiscent of the murder that occurred for the Amish community at Nickel Mines a decade ago, where they forgave that man quickly, and it had a lot to do with their deep connection to Jesus and their feeling that that's what Jesus wanted them to do. And so while it may be true that people who have a deep spiritual connection and have practiced this way of being, that it's possible to be sincere and deeply truthful, for most people, forgiving this quickly is in some way short-circuiting the horror and the outrage that we need to feel to know what it is that we're forgiving. That, you know, we're forswearing revenge and we're forswearing bitterness, because we've explored revenge and bitterness and don't want to go there. That's the usual course of forgiveness, that you suffer first, you grieve first, you get rocked to your core first, and then out of that comes some other qualities.
And what about experiencing outrage? And I'll use as an example, one of the family members of one of the victims, who is also a reverend, admitted that she wasn't at the point of forgiveness, and that, as you've just described, it's a process. So would you agree with her point of view about forgiveness at this point?
I would think if there's a takeaway for the average person, that's probably the strongest takeaway, is to allow yourself to grieve, allow yourself to feel all the human emotions before you accept that you're done with them and are willing to just let it go. Now, what the other piece of that is, this fits in line with the way grief generally goes, that in the grieving process, there's anger, there's despair, there's making peace, there's bargaining, there's denial, there's all those things. That appears in some formula to be how human beings integrate back into life after they've been shattered. And so there is some time that most of us need. However, I will say that there is a small percentage of people who have done the work in advance through their religious faith and their religious practice, so they don't have the same level of outrage or even horror, not even outrage, just how could somebody do this?
And that would explain why so many of the family members were able to forgive as quickly as they did.
That's my explanation. You know, I'll tell you personally, when I heard about this, I personally was sickened. And I went through real inner dialogue. Like, I don't, you know, not that I have anything to forgive. They didn't harm me. But I went through real inner dialogue in my own head about, okay, this is such a grotesque act to go into a church and shoot people and make believe that you're interested in Bible study. I mean, it's so profane that I was trying to figure out, what's an appropriate punishment for this? Like, what do you do with a human being who has so violated any human decency? And I struggled with it. I really did. I called a couple of friends and said, I don't even know. Like, what do you do? Because I was battling, you know, do you give compassion? Do you throw the key away? Do you kill him? Like, I had no clarity because the event was so awful. But, you know, a couple of days later, my normalcy is returning and I can think more clearly. And there's just something about, for the average person, allowing that process to occur while remembering that you yourself don't want to give up your human decency just because somebody else did.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with Fred Luskin, director of the Stanford University Forgiveness Project. Dr. Luskin, why is forgiveness from the victim's standpoint necessary, in especially in light of such a heinous crime? And you outlined the struggle that many people would have with arriving at forgiveness without first feeling some level of intense outrage.
Yeah, and grief. Well, one of the reasons it's so difficult is, you know, violence like this shatters our sense that it's a predictable world, that there's no reason for this murder. I mean, except, you know, human hatred and evil. There's no, like, you know, all of us can understand, like, a lover's quarrel that gets out of hand, or, you know, a family vendetta. You know what I'm saying? Where
sure.
We recognize that there's some history or something personal. This was simply racist. And it's hard for any of us to integrate this into what we think people are like. You know, it's frightening, and it causes us to go, wow, this world is a dangerous place. And so we all have to deal with that in some ways. Like, how do we live in a world like that? And that takes time to make some peace. The reason forgiveness is so essential is, if you don't deal with it on a personal level, then you're burdened by it for too long. You know, it's like, yes, there's evil, and yes, awful things happen, and yes, human beings suffer. And this is also a beautiful world that you have to be in also. And if you don't forgive, you stay too long in the suffering. That's why it's so tricky. So forgiveness is the exit door that says, you know, I'm done with this. I don't need to ruin another day because of this.
But how does one begin to forgive especially something as you've described, such a heinous crime?
Well, part of it is allowing the process to unfold, because in almost anyone, after a while, the process of resentment and hating harms the hate. You know what I mean? Like, no matter how bad something is, if you're cycling it and regurgitating it every day for the next 3 years, you're going to burn your whole body out, and you're going to burn out your mind. And so after a while, normally, we get as tired of our own negativity as we do of anything that happened to us. That's the natural course of things. That, you know, you deal with it, and then one day you wake up and say, wait a second, there's got to be a better way. The sun's still shining out there. I don't want to blame this person anymore. But it's usually a process that you have to go through. Then, when you recognize that you want to change yourself, then you start taking steps to heal yourself, which is separating yourself from the past. It's saying, well, I need to have a decent life today. This might have happened 2 years ago, and it was awful and an atrocity, but today I don't want it to be the dominant thing in my life. That's not what I want. I want other things to be front and center. And so there's a transition. So it is a natural process, if not hindered. And unfortunately, the people that I work with have hindered the process by staying furious, by not allowing compassion in, by deciding that somebody's evil and they should be punished in their minds forever. Those are all things that hinder, to me, the natural course of things.
Tell us about the work you've done with the Forgiveness Project.
Well, I mean, for almost 20 years now, we've been teaching and researching how to help people forgive. And it's a tough thing, you know, because many people are desperately hurt, like these family members. For no reason that they can think of, somebody does something horrendous. And so we've dealt with that in different parts of the world, and we tend not to take murder victims' families anywhere less than 2 years after the murder, because it probably could be done a little earlier than that, but we tend to just want to have people have plenty of time to process, to deal with it, to do whatever they can, and then we're willing to say, okay, it's time to let it go, and such to speak. So we have dealt with this in different places and taught people a reasonably simple methodology. I've written a very successful book called Forgive for Good, which details that methodology. And so have a couple of other, you know, university professors. And we've come up with one way that people can work through this and come out the other side.
Dr. Fred Luskin is the director of the Stanford University Forgiveness Project. Dr. Luskin, we appreciate your joining us here on Essential Pittsburgh and sharing this information with us today.
Well, thank you so very much.
And more Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Local artist Alexi Morrissey is turning the traditional kid on a milk carton campaign of the 1980s into an art project that commemorates the lives lost during the slave trade. Mr. Morrissey has already produced 5 unique depictions of Africans replicated from historical documents for the project titled Have You Seen Me? Mentored in ceramics as a youth offender, as part of a youth offender program for habitual graffiti felons in Boston in the 80s, he went on to graduate work at Carnegie Mellon. He joins us now in studio to explain his inspiration behind this modern-day memorial to African lives lost to slavery. Alexi Morrissey, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much.
First, explain to our listeners who may not remember or be old enough to remember it, the Kid on a Milk Carton campaign. What was it intended for, and how did it come about?
Yeah, the Have You Seen Me, which was a phrase that was written, was adopted and created entirely by dairy farmers. It was an independent, it had nothing to do with the United States government. It didn't have to do with local authorities. Quite simply, early on, in Anderson Erickson Dairy in Iowa, there was a kid named Johnny Gosch, and he went missing in the neighborhood. And it was a small town, and they weren't really prepared for that. They didn't have the internet. They didn't have the things that we associate with organizing and advocacy. So Anderson Erickson put Johnny Gosch on their milk carton, and they said, our milk cartons go into homes every day. We're going to get the word out. And Have You Seen Me is the voice of the missing person. So Johnny Gosch said from the milk carton, have you seen me? Which is an important parallel to our project, because we're giving a voice to the slave. Have you seen me? Rather than speaking for them.
And what struck you as the way, as this being the means for creating the kind of awareness that you want to create mm-hmm. with regard to the legacy of slavery, is that this was not a government program. It mm-hmm. wasn't something that, it was a very organic thing,
sure.
the way it arose originally in the 80s.
Yeah, and, you know, it became a little bit too intense, I think. The parents complained, and the project picked up steam and became part of a mail program, and people still get Have You Seen Me mailers in the mail. But over 1,000 United States independent dairy farmers did this. It caught on really quick, and then it went away. But the missing persons advocacy movement built on that. And so now advocacy, we're really aware of that as consumers. We have Live Strong for Cancer. We have the Race for the Cure. Everything that we associate, it's tied to brands now. It's different. But back then, it was very new, and it was a spiritual act.
What are you seeking to do? Some people might look at this and say, well, I understand the milk carton campaigns of the mm-hmm. 80s, because presumably if you put a picture of a missing child on these milk cartons, mm-hmm. that someone might recognize it, or someone might say, oh, that kid, I saw him the other day down the street, and then
right.
they might presumably call the authorities and something can be done. These reproductions are of lost souls and mm-hmm. of something that we unfortunately cannot change in our history. So someone looking at this might say, well, what's the point?
Well, I think that's a fair question. And, you know, I'm an artist, and I come from a tradition of just being open to the idea. The idea itself can be seen as a self-aware, sentient creation. Many artists have written about that over the years, the muses in Greek society. So I take inspiration from that. And so this idea was given to me, like all artists get ideas, and I built upon it. And to answer your question, I would say that this work is classically, beyond the slave memorial, what we're trying to do in our timeline. These bottles are what's called alternate history. And alternate history has a long tradition. Shakespeare wrote alternate history plays. Everyone is familiar with that in sci-fi. And so I read a lot of comic books growing up, watched a lot of sci-fi. So this is an alternate history. The slaves on our milk bottles don't have names. So they're given names by the translators. I work with first language speakers from African states. The first 5 bottles we made from Nigeria, in Igbo language and in the Yoruba language. So people look at this, it's a work of art. And
they're real people.
Yeah, they're real people, but they're not playing themselves on the bottle, because their names were taken from them. So these bottles are fictional. We create fictional dairies. We get them branded using professional advertising firms. So we build a company for each bottle, just so that you can have this frame of reference that you're used to, which is branding and identity and logos. And on the back, there's the slave in our timeline, but in this alternate history, they're a person that has hope. You don't put up a wanted poster for someone that you know is kidnapped and taken. So the hope in our project is fictional. And the reality of history is this person on the milk bottle has been dead for 100 years and their life was taken from them and they had no freedom and no hope. So those two things power the art process of contemplation. And these are designed to be taken into your homes, just like you would take the milk carton. And they're designed for you as, these are old school conversation pieces.
And there's one sitting right in front of us. So sure. Why don't we have you describe it? Again, this is made of porcelain.
Right.
And I'm holding it in my hand, and mm-hmm. it's beautifully designed. It is, you know, the craftsmanship here is quite remarkable. But obviously, the importance here is in the telling of the story.
Yeah, but also I would also agree and expand on that and saying the reason why it's out of porcelain. I could have made these out of glass milk bottles. I could have had them made out of wax cartons.
Well, porcelain is your specialty, right?
Well, porcelain has become my specialty over the last 3 years. My art practice is based on the materials best suited for the most direct expression of the idea. I'm not allowed to have a specialty. Even though I was trained in the ceramic program when I was young, when I went on to art school, I was told that the city was my studio, and that was it. So I derive whatever idea comes in my studio, I just do. So I had to become an expert on porcelain, which is really interesting because I didn't understand porcelain's history until I did this project. My grandmother had porcelain, but she didn't call it that. She called it china. And a lot of people's grandmothers have china. And china is one of these things that's passed down from generation to generation. So the choosing of porcelain was very specific because it's a very freighted historical material. And the Chinese invented it as part of a funerary ware, which was lost during like the scramble to fetishize it by the Europeans. So these are headstones. What you're looking at is a headstone. And so it's a distributed memorial inside people's homes throughout the world. And it's decentralized because we don't need to have anybody's permission to do that. And so not only does it enter your home and create a conversation, you are actually building a legitimate memorial to slavery when you collect one of these.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking with artist Alexi Morrissey, who has taken advantage or capitalized, I'm not sure what the exact wording should be, but used the old milk carton campaign of the 1980s, which brought attention to missing children, to commemorate lives lost during the slave trade. If you have a comment or question for our guest, Alexi Morrissey, about his art project commemorating the lives lost during the slave trade, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. So what led you to decide that this was the best way? I'm sure you contemplated a variety of different ways to look at this legacy that we have trouble speaking about in the United States.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a little bit about my process, you know, as an artist. What happens is what you would imagine how it would be is there's a flash of light and a very brief amount of information, and then it's my job not to mess that up. So I'm more of like a hired hand to the idea. And, you know, I was vacuuming the nursery of my baby, and he was young. He just turned 5. This was many years ago. And I just saw a slave on a milk carton. And that was it. And after that, there's really nothing else for me to do but try to expand that. So I'm not the type of person that can sit down and design a whole thing. You know, there's a lot of really smart people out there who are leading the conversation about race, who are preserving slavery, who are trying to force people to sort of just take a step back and contribute to conversations or just simply listen. My job as an artist is to take things, sometimes not make them new, but take things that already exist. Everything on this milk bottle is appropriated from a different type of reality, whether it's the milk carton kids or the anxiety of advertising, which created the milk carton kids. And so this is the first crowdsourced memorial to slavery. It's on Kickstarter right now. We're a staff pick. So it's crowdsourced in terms of funding, but it's also crowdsourced in terms of making. And when you bring one of these bottles into your home, the bottle, even though they're all going to be in different languages and all have different people on them that are missing, they all have the same text that says, "Have you seen me?" And "Have you seen me?" is a question that's asked to you.
So that leads to my next question, which was, who is this artwork intended for?
Well, the thing is that this artwork has its own consciousness. And, you know, right now, you and I are sitting in a radio studio. We're both dashing middle-aged white men. And we are looking at this bottle, which is in Yoruba, and you can't read it. I know that you can't.
You shouldn't necessarily assume that, but you are in fact correct. I cannot read it.
So you can make associations right off the bat. The first thing your brain does is it says, that's a milk bottle. That's your brain. That's not your mind. So already off the bat, I'm leading you down a path. So I know your brain's going to say, milk bottle, not English person. And all of a sudden, you might start to develop a relationship with it. But the thing is that I once gave one of these bottles to the Minister of Culture of Nigeria, and he was the first person that could read it instantly that I'd ever met. Hmm. And it was after hours in a club of expat Africans in Pittsburgh, and he started crying, and he grabbed me, and he was really emotional. And I had never experienced anything like that in the last 3 years, because I'm just a studio artist working in my studio producing these things. But now that it's transformed from a regular art project that you would see in a gallery to something that has a larger impact. So who is this for? Slaves built the United States of America and affected everything in the world. Slaves were the startup capital of the greatest capitalistic experiment in the world, which is the USA. This bottle's for everybody, because everybody is affected by slavery.
And, you know, when you get the kind of reaction that you just described, Is there something about this that, and I think maybe the scenario you just described with someone who looks at the bottle and can't immediately understand what's on it, that for them, the process, it takes a little longer to sink in. But explain your feelings about how we as Americans, how we have not come to grips with this country's history with the slave trade and its long-lasting effects, and how this is some way of allowing that message to sink in.
Right. So one of the things that you get used to as an artist, or someone who I'm also a poet and I perform, I've been in film, I've been in theater, audiences are a large part of my consciousness. And so a lot of people who are professional creators understand that the audience is part of the equation. And so this is an audience-generated artwork. If people don't take these bottles into their homes, the memorial to slavery does not get built. So when you're making an audience-generated artwork, you're under a different set of logistical and technical and conceptual considerations than you would if you just want to make a painting and show it in a gallery. So the thing here is, I know when I look at this bottle and when you look at this bottle and the alternate history of this bottle, there's no America on this bottle. There's no plantations on this bottle. There's no slavery implied on this bottle. The alternate history here is the root of just trying to find out what the average African thought about slavery at the time, which is really hard to find because it was a pre-literate society. So how do individual people feel at that time? And it's really difficult. A lot of people smarter than me try to find slave diaries or whatever. But the thing is that what the audience brings to this bottle, which is a fictional alternate history of missing people in Africa about Africa, what they bring to it is slavery in the United States, race relations, civil rights, 9 people being assassinated in a church just recently. I depend on my audience to bring their experiences to this bottle rather than me telling people what to think or what to be or what to feel. I know that there's enough consciousness out there for people to imprint it on the artwork. And so the audience generation just isn't the logistical building of the memorial. It's allowing them to change how this thing is by what they think and what they feel.
And, you know, I just picked this up with one hand and I was kind of bringing it to me, and for just a nanosecond there, the balance was kind of tricky, and I almost felt like it was going to slip from my hands, which kind of brings to mind the idea that this is fragile material that you've created this out of. So what are the risks of doing it this way?
Well, the thing is that a lot of people have a lot of precious things in their homes. My grandmother had a china set that when I lived with them, I was raised by my grandparents. It never left the china cabinet. I don't know who was supposed to come over the house to eat off the china, but people are used to having precious things, extremely precious things. And so the thing is, I depend on people's innate nature as human beings to protect their precious things and realize that the most precious thing on this bottle is the image of the African slave. And so we have to treat that seriously. And porcelain is one of the hardest materials in the world. When Marco Polo brought porcelain to Europe in the 1500s, the Europeans spent 200 years trying to figure out how to make it, which is why porcelain is expensive today, because one of the greatest scientific collection of people couldn't make porcelain. They didn't know how to do it. And porcelain is a fetish object, and it's beautiful. And in China, they say at mealtime, you eat with your eyes first. So I depend on this thing being beautiful. And it is fragile, conceptually and physically. But the thing is that fragility engenders you to protect it.
So who else is involved in creating this work? There's quite a team that you've assembled.
Yeah, well, we have a local historian, Marcus Redeker, who just is an amazing human being. He's really lent himself to me. He wrote The Slave Ship, A People's History, which I encourage everyone to read. He also wrote the de facto last word on the Amistad Rebellion. He's a documentary filmmaker as well. Wall-to-Wall Studios, a design firm here in town, made three bottles. Larkin Werner, the creative director, I asked him to pretend he was hired by this dairy, and he understood how to do that, to work in a fictional way to produce real results. We have our translators who translate bottles, but they also come up with the names of the missing, and it's all transparent. They know what they're doing. And talking to Africans about slavery is much different than talking to Americans about slavery. Right now, we've got a translator who just submitted the next three bottles. They're going to be in a language from Benin, and he's one of the most famous linguists in the world. And he challenged me to change a few things about the project, which was very challenging and very uncomfortable. But he wrote me an email. He teaches in the Netherlands, and he's from Benin in Africa. And he found out about my project through the MIT Linguistics Department, where I also have connections. And he said, I love your project. This needs to change. And I love it, and I'm doing it. So the translators drive a lot of what's going on. And this project evolves. It can't just be about me and my ideas, because I'm small and not capable of doing something this large without a big team of people.
What were some of the things that needed to be changed?
Well, one of the things that he wanted to talk to me about, which where I grew up in Boston, which you can, in the current conversation about race is really difficult. Like, a lot of people think the South is racist and the North isn't. It's a trope in America, but the North is really racist. Boston was really racist growing up.
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of things going on with Boston. It's where the abolitionist movement
began,
but it's also where there was a race war over busing.
So yeah, it was the last public school system to desegregate. Malcolm X, in his book with Alex Haley, said Boston's the most racist place he's ever been. So, you know, where I grew up, it was a white supremacist talking point to stop any conversation about slavery by saying, well, they, in quotes, sold each other. So it's their fault. The Africans sold their own people to us. And, you know, when you're 12 years old and you hear that, and if you don't have anything under your belt, if you haven't read a book, you know, I was taught that slavery was wrong and it ended with Civil War, the end. And there's so much more to it than that. And this gentleman, Enoch Abo sent me a list of events from his country in the 1700s where battles were won and lost and people were put into slavery because of that. And I had to go from my aversion to learning about that to accepting that this was a part of the equation and there's a lot of guilt and shame in Africa about slavery. And it's taboo in some African nations to even talk about it or bring it up. This has been told to me directly by people who do research in this there. So I can't be afraid to have any conversation about this art project, because I need to grow and I need to learn.
We've been talking with an artist from the Pittsburgh area, Alexi Morrissey, about his art project commemorating the lives lost during the slave trade. Joining us here in studio, Alexi Morrissey, thank you so much for being with us.
Please check out our Kickstarter. It's called Have You Seen Me? A Memorial to Slavery. Look it up on Kickstarter. It ends July 17th.
Sounds good. Thank you. Coming up, the woman behind the tribute titled Naomi Sims, First Black Supermodel, Art Insider, Beauty Icon. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Naomi Sims is regarded by many as fashion's first African-American supermodel. Many locals, however, may not realize that Sims grew up in Pittsburgh and attended Westinghouse High School. Kalolo Luckett will present a lecture paying tribute to Sims tonight at the Carnegie Museum of Art titled Naomi Sims, First Black Supermodel, Art Insider, Beauty Icon. She joins us now in studio. Kalolo Luckett, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
And if you have a story or impression of Naomi Sims or your own tribute you'd like to share, you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is essspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at essspgh. Kalolo Luckett, let's begin by having you explain how Naomi Sims broke ground in the 60s and 70s.
Sure. So I just want to step back a little bit and just kind of paint the picture for you about
her.
Sure. So Naomi Sims was born in 1948, March 30th, in Oxford, Mississippi. And then she moved up to Pittsburgh as a child and lived in a Lincoln, Lymington, Homewood area. And she also graduated. She attended and graduated Westinghouse and then left for New York in 1966. And so it was about a year after that she landed on the cover of the New York Times Fashion of the Times magazine in 1967. And so that was the first time an actual black model was photographed and featured on a mainstream magazine.
How did that happen?
I think it was a couple of things. Being at the right time, at the right place at the right time. Also, her tenacity and confidence to really be a part of and experience something that really wasn't happening at the time, but there was this momentum that was growing across the country as far as the Black arts movement, the Black is Beautiful campaign. Those all kind of gave rise to this kind of groundswell of women, beauty, black women being taken more seriously.
And hadn't there been or weren't there other important black models on the fashion scene?
That's a good question. There have been black models in the history of fashion. However, black models tended to be only seen in black-owned publications like Jet or Ebony magazine. There was really no crossover in the mainstream magazines like Vogue or Harper's Bazaar.
Well, was there also sort of this idea, pardon me for interrupting, but mm-hmm. was there also this idea that really only, 10 years before, and I'm thinking of this because Johnny Mathis is coming to Pittsburgh, and he was someone who, among other great artists at that particular time, was someone whose voice you heard, but his image, as with other African-American artists, was sort of kept from the public. Do you know what I mean? In the sense that oh, no, we don't want to acknowledge that all of this great work is coming from people that we have traditionally held at arm's length in society. And so in only 10 years, something changes, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think a lot of that has to do with the civil rights movement in the early 60s. I think that you have a model like Danielle Luna, for example, who is probably one of the more known models. Are you familiar with Danielle Luna?
I am not.
Okay, I shouldn't make the assumption.
I've probably seen her, though.
Yeah. Well, she was really probably the first model to kind of cross over, but she had only established herself in America for just a brief time before moving to Europe for other opportunities.
What year would this?
And this would have been in 1965.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. But so there were other black models, but once again, they were kind of put in a box. And so the lack of opportunities for them prior to the civil rights movement really put them at a disadvantage.
Right. And I'm trying to think of who, you know, maybe Lena Horne, I don't know, that you would have seen acknowledged for her beauty, who was a black woman.
Right. Well, I could give you an example. Diane Carroll.
Julia,
yes.
I remember that show when I was a kid. Remember her show.
Yes, I'm glad you do. Well, Diane Carroll tried out modeling first before acting, and she kept getting, as you said, stiff arm. She kept getting turned down. People aren't ready to see a black woman in this light. So she just kept getting deferred to a point where she just said, to the heck with this. I'm going to focus on acting. And so, lo and behold, she ends up having a major role in Julia.
Right, which was a groundbreaking show. And,
it sure
and
was.
Something that she can, I'm sure, look back on her career and be proud of. But getting back to Naomi Sims, I'm looking at a picture of her, she's, you know, a classic, you know, model's build, the sinewy woman. Whether she was black or white, you would look at her frame and say, okay, yes, the with the smaller hips, that this is a woman who would be a perfect model. But then beyond that, there is a striking beauty. And just describe some of her features for us and the things that would have caught a photographer's eye.
Sure. So she was 5'10". And she was very statuesque and very elegant. A lot of photographers always said how she could make a burlap sack look amazing just by her stature alone. She had these very angular, beautiful facial features. And she was just, she had this heart-shaped face. She had this dark, creamy skin that really illuminated and glowed. So she was just this true natural beauty who happened to be black.
And so for you, you obviously are someone who appreciates her and admires what she was able to accomplish. What inspired you to put this presentation together?
Wow, a couple of things. So first and foremost, I would say, as a black woman looking, going to the library as a child, I was such a geek in libraries. I love libraries. Rarely did I ever see books about women of color. And that was very discouraging to me as a child. So I always sought them out. I wanted that kind of affirmation. And as I got older, that just kept staying in my mind. And so I would always gravitate to any book about a black woman. And there aren't really that many even today. And so as I learned about Naomi Sims as a young child, and understanding and knowing that, you know, she came from Mississippi just like me, and then I ended up in Pittsburgh and she lived in Pittsburgh, I started to kind of peel back her life. And I realized that there wasn't much to her out there other than her being this first black supermodel. And then I started kind of doing my own research and saw that she wrote these four books about all about health care and hair and beauty and success for Black women, and also how to be a top model. And so I started to kind of piece together information about her, but I realized that that wasn't enough. I needed to get really serious about doing this work and doing this research on her. Because if you Google her, you see all these glamorous pictures, but there's not anything that really talks about her impact in the arts, for example, or her work in beauty, her volunteerism with education, child health care. So those are all really important things that a model during this time period wasn't necessarily doing. Nowadays, you see somebody like Tyra Banks. She has a show. She has her own cosmetic line. That all pointed back to Naomi. She was kind of that groundbreaker back then.
Paving the way for all of the Black women that followed.
Absolutely. And even some white women, too, because even during this time period of the 60s and 70s, you weren't seeing any model doing the amount of work. I mean, while she was modeling, she was writing her books. That's something that you just don't hear of. You didn't hear about that back in during this time period. So she was above and beyond just a model. She embodied more than just this beautiful face. She was extremely smart. She actually skipped a grade in high school. She was able to travel a lot and to go to different countries, experience other cultures, bring that back. Her children's book, when she wrote a children's book when she was 21 years old in 1971, that gives this character this Japanese name. I mean, so there's just so many things about her that people don't know. And I think through this work that I'm doing, it really empowers me as a woman and a woman of color, that, yes, there is a place in the world for me.
We're talking with Kalolo Luckett, who is presenting a lecture tonight paying tribute to Naomi Sims, the first African-American supermodel. The lecture is at the Carnegie Museum of Art. It's titled Naomi Sims, First Black Supermodel, Art Insider Beauty Icon. And this presentation will begin at what time tonight?
At 6:30, and it is at the Carnegie Music Hall. It was moved from the theater based on the high volume of people that are interested in attending tonight.
Good for you. Good. That's great. That's good to hear that there's that interest there. And again, get there maybe with traffic, you know, shoot for 6 so that you're there on time. And we've got about a minute or so left. What became of Naomi Sims?
That's a good question. So, unfortunately, she died from breast cancer in 2009 at the age of 61. And she tended to go really full tilt during her active years as a model and while she was writing her books and running her business, her cosmetic and wig company, up until about, I would say, the early 90s. And then she started to kind of become more private in her life and be less active because of personal reasons and health reasons.
And in just the last few seconds, how would you sum up the legacy of Naomi Sims?
I think that that's something that would be this woman that I would say is somebody who was misunderstood in a way, that she was only like just this beautiful woman, but yet she was more to it than that. I mean, she was an entrepreneur, a businesswoman who was paving the path for women of all likes in all colors.
Broke a lot of new ground. Naomi Sims, First Black Supermodel, Art Insider, Beauty Icon. That is the title of the lecture being presented tonight by our guest, Kalolo Luckett, at the Carnegie Museum of Art. It begins at 6:30. Kalolo Luckett, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Paul.
If you missed any segment of any portion of our program or want to catch past segments, go to our website, wesa.fm. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.